Well, in our message this morning, we are continuing our study in Paul's letter to the Romans, and we are toward the end of this book, turning again this morning to Romans chapter 15, Romans chapter 15, and our text is going to be specifically verses 22 to 29, Romans 15, 22 to 29, and I'd like to begin by going ahead and reading that passage. We'll give you a sense of the direction that we'll be heading in the message. Romans 15, starting verse 22. This is the reason why I have so often been hindered from coming to you. And let me stop there. What is the reason? He is referring back to what we saw last week, that the Lord had kept Paul very busy reaching out to areas of the world that had never heard the gospel. And so as far as his ministry to this church that was already founded, he just had not been able to fit them in yet. And he wants them to know why. This is the reason why I have so often been hindered from coming to you. But now, since I no longer have any room for work in these regions, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, I hope to see you in passing, as I go to Spain, and be helped on my journey there by you once I have enjoyed your company for a while. At present, however, I am going to Jerusalem, bringing aid to the saints, for Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some contribution for the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. For they were pleased to do it. And indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be of service to them in material blessings. When therefore I have completed this and have delivered to them what has been collected, I will leave for Spain by way of you. I know that when I come to you, I will come in the fullness of the blessing of Christ. Now, by reading that, you can tell that we continue in a section that is pretty specific historically and pretty narrow as far as Paul's plans and his desire to go to Rome, and something really pretty limited in what is under discussion here. We read that, and even though some of the expressions might strike us as significant or encouraging to us, overall, we probably have a hard time finding some kind of direct relevance for our lives. And I think in cases like this especially, we want to adjust a little bit the way we think about the Bible. You know, there's a passage over in James that says that the Bible is like a mirror. And so we look at the Word of God and reflects our self back to us so that we know where we stand and what's going on and what the needs are and what has to be changed. And a lot of passages are very, very much like a mirror that way. You read it, and the truth of it is so directly related to your life and your experience that there's very little you need to do in terms of sorting out, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? A lot of the Bible is that way, functioning like a mirror very directly. Other passages, yes, eventually they're going to be relevant, but when you initially look at them, they really aren't like mirrors so much. It's more like you're looking out a window, and you're not right away seeing yourself and your struggles and your relationship with the Lord and your life. You're not seeing yourself directly. It's really more like looking out a window and seeing some vista out there. And you're looking out on different specifics of life as they were in the times of the Bible, different historical incidents, highly particular circumstances that those people were facing. And here you are staring at this mirror, not at the mirror so much, but at a window. What are you supposed to do with that? Well, those kinds of windows, I think, are designed by the Lord to kind of broaden our thinking, to help us take this little trip to what things were like back then, to expose us to what he was doing in the lives of certain people back there, so that through that we'll pick up on certain patterns of how he operated in their lives that actually continue to be the ways that he works in our lives as well. We look out the window, we see this vista, we pick up on some of these patterns, and we come back to our world and we start looking around and we look at ourselves as well. We see, now how is what I have seen going to shape the way that I think about my life and the way that I go about striving to serve the Lord? That is the kind of passage that we are looking at here. And when you read this particular text, you look at that vista, there are a number of things that stand out. There are a number of truths that you are seeing at work in Paul's comments here about his travel plans. One of the things that stands out to me is that there are some statements that have to do with God's providence. So right away in verse 22, "This is the reason why I have so often been hindered from coming to you." Paul says, actually, in the verses that followed, "I have for many years wanted to come to you, and it just hasn't worked out because of other things God has had me doing." He speaks about his desire to go with them, be with them, and to partner with them in the ministry. And he is beginning to make plans, and yet not exactly sure how and when this is all going to happen. And looking to the Lord with an attitude of really whatever the Lord wants, and yet at the same time, toward the end of the passage, verse 29, assured that God is going to bless his efforts, and because this is gospel work, he is certain that the Lord is going to favor his ministry, though he may not know all the details of exactly when and how. What are we talking about there but a man who has a firm confidence in the sovereignty of God, even the providence of God, when things don't work out when he wants them to, and things seem to hinder good gospel things that he's wanting to do. He says, "I have wanted to come to you for many years, but I have been hindered because of other things that have taken place." I think that's a helpful reminder, because all of us face any number of delays and hindrances, even when we are sincerely trying to do something for the Lord. That happened to me this morning. I was a few miles down the highway, and I asked myself the question I always ask myself, only it was a little late: did I bring my Bible with me? Do I have my sermon notes with me? And that time, I think for the first time ever, the answer was no. So that's why I was not in Sunday school this morning. And now you know. Little things can derail our plans. Those are just mistakes we make or minor inconveniences along the way. But sometimes it really can be very frustrating that we are genuinely wanting to accomplish some goal for the work of Christ, and circumstantially, it just doesn't happen, and there's really not a lot we can do to fix it. Paul dealt with this a lot. As you read the accounts of his life and ministry in Acts, as you read some of the comments he makes in the epistles, God opening doors, God closing doors, God unexpectedly, at the last minute, directing him over here, getting arrested over there, and his life was... he could not be a micromanager and have his life planned out for the next 20 years. It just didn't work that way. He had some objectives, but there were all kinds of detours and delays along the way. I think even though that's not the main point of this passage, it certainly is a truth that is opened up to us as we look at the ministry of Paul here. Now, what is the focus of this passage? As the Apostle Paul deals with his travel plans, he is emphasizing the purpose he's wanting to accomplish. Doesn't know all the details of how it's going to work out, but he does have a certain purpose that he is targeting. And that purpose has primarily to do with money. And it has primarily to do with the people of God giving money. This morning, we're going to talk about money because that's what this passage is talking about. When you draw back the curtain and you look at what's lying out there outside the window and what opens up, it's a story of a lot of money that is being collected, or money that is being requested to be collected, all of it in some way for the work of God. And so I'd like to title the message this morning, A Window into New Testament Giving. A Window into New Testament Giving. And what you find here is that there are two kinds of giving that Paul is talking about, two kinds of giving that Paul is describing here, both of which have great relevance for our service for the Lord today. The first of those we could call giving to missionaries in verses 23 and 24, giving to missionaries. And most of it has to do with giving, as we would normally think of it, material giving, finances, financial support, funds, supplies, whatever is needed in a material way to carry out the work that Paul envisions as he is heading out towards Spain. This part of the letter is where Paul actually does talk about coming in order to pass out an offering plate. He says specifically in verse 23, since I no longer have any room for work in these regions, meaning, as I mentioned last week, that he had been used of the Lord to plant churches in these major hubs of civilization, accomplish his pioneering work, and then going out further. Since that work is done, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, verse 24, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain and to be helped on my journey there by you. That's the part I want to focus on here. He wants to come and to be helped on his journey. That phrase reflects one verb that occurs 9 times in the New Testament and all really having to do with the same idea. To be helped on my journey is kind of a descriptive sort of translation. It's really a word that has to do with sending. To be sent forth would be a good way to put it. To be commissioned by you, we might say. To be enabled by your help to advance in some gospel endeavor. And you say, well, what specifically would that look like, that they would help him on his journey or send him forth? And we don't have to wonder. There are actually many things, but there's one thing in particular that stands out as you look at most of these passages. I'm going to read them for you, several of them anyway. You can look them up if you'd like. The first one is in Acts 15. And in Acts 15, you have the story of Paul and Barnabas, who were not at that time in Jerusalem. They were working with another assembly. And there was this controversy that came up about the Gentiles and circumcision. And so they finally decide, we're going to go to Jerusalem to talk to the leaders of that church and get this all worked out. Eventually, what's called the Jerusalem Council unfolds there in chapter 15. And it says in Acts 15, verse 3, so, quote, being sent on their way by the church, they passed through both Phoenicia and Samaria, describing in detail the conversion of the Gentiles and brought great joy to all the brothers. So kind of their home church sponsors them as their representative to go to Jerusalem and get this issue worked out. Then the next one I want to share is in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verses 5 and 6. Paul says to the believers at Corinth, kind of like what he's saying here, I will visit you, making plans to come visit them, after passing through Macedonia, for I intend to pass through Macedonia, and perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. Paul's got these plans. He's taking this trip. He wants to make a stop in Corinth. And what's going to happen there? They're going to put him up. They're going to feed him. They're going to give him what he needs. They're going to help him on his journey in that sense. That becomes clear as we look at some of these other passages. Actually, one of them is in that 1 Corinthians 16 as well, down in verse 10, verse 11. Paul says, when Timothy comes, see that you may put him at ease among you, for he is doing the work of the Lord as I am, so let no one despise him. Here it is. Help him on his way in peace, that he may return to me, for I am expecting him with the brothers. Now he's talking about Timothy needing the same kind of sponsorship or funding or provision so that he can do what God has called him to do. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 16, Paul says, I wanted to visit you on my way to Macedonia and to come back to you from Macedonia and have you send me on my way to Judea. Another one is Titus chapter 3 and verse 13. Paul's talking about some other people. Do your best to speed Zenas, the lawyer, and Apollos on their way. That's the same expression, speed these people on their way. And then right away, next line, see that they lack nothing. That's the main thing that they need to get sped on their way. Today we might say they need somebody to put gas in their tank or to provide food for them or put them up in a motel, whatever it looked like in the first century. See that they lack nothing so that they can make progress in their mission. And then especially 3 John chapter 1, the only chapter in there, verses 5 to 8, makes this point. 3 John 5 to 8. Beloved, it is a faithful thing you do in all your efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are, who testify to your love before the church. These brothers, strangers as they are. We're talking about traveling, itinerant Christian workers, evangelists, missionaries, Bible teachers, whatever you might call them. He's referring to how they treated those people and how they still should as they come through. He goes on to say, you will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. And that kind of ups the ante, doesn't it? It's not just about helping these people who are trying to do good things. It's to do this in a manner that would be worthy of God. I mean, to view these people as the ambassadors for God that they are, and to provide for them richly so that they can accomplish their God-given mission. Send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. Why? For they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. So in other words, these people weren't going out on the street just begging from the average unconverted Gentile person there to just give them money. They're not accepting funds from people outside of their group and definitely not asking for it anyway. Therefore, we ought to support people like these that we may be fellow workers for the truth. You see, clearly he's talking about financial sponsorship using the same word to send forth. And what that does when you provide for the needs of God's servants that way is that it actually causes you to be a partner with them. This is not a metaphor. This is in a very concrete way. You are a fellow worker with them. You are linking up with them as a part of their team so that the work can be accomplished. And at the end of the day, if there is no provision, the work is not going to be accomplished. This is why the New Testament puts such a strong emphasis on the financial support of missionaries. Now, that is the burden that Paul has as far as his trip is concerned. And as I mentioned before, really, the whole letter is feeding right into those verses because he wants them to know by giving them this exposition of the gospel, this is the message I'm going to go out there to preach. It's the same message you believe. I want you to be encouraged by it. I want you to know what it is that I'm going to be preaching to people. And when I come to you and I'm relying on you for support, this is what you are helping me to proclaim. We are fellow workers, and this is what we are jointly carrying out in the world, which has great relevance for us as a local church. This week, I got an email from one of our supported missionaries saying that another one of their churches has been dwindling down, and it looks like they're going to lose $300 a month of their financial support. And you just think about your own budget and what just $300 disappearing all of a sudden would mean and what you could or could not do as a result of that sort of thing. This stuff happens all the time. I am regularly reading missionary letters. We have 10 that our church supports. There are many others that I personally am in contact with. And there's just a flood of correspondence. A lot of it has to do with money. That's just the reality of life, that in a material world like we have, it takes money to do anything. It takes money for you to get to church. It takes money for you to go to school. It takes money for this building to be open and for the utilities to be paid. It takes money to accomplish the work of Christ, particularly as people are traveling over there and doing this kind of pioneer work. It's really been a great joy to me that as a church, mentioned this from time to time, we try and the Lord has enabled us to set apart around 25 to 30% of our budget directly to missionary support, so that for every dollar you put in the offering, about a quarter of that goes to the work of Christ in other places. You know, we can get so used to that and seeing these missionaries come through and seeing their reports and interacting with them and giving our money that it just becomes very commonplace. And we hardly even think about it. We just, you know, put my check in the offering and that's just kind of the routine I have and this is what I do. Well, I think it should be something we're faithfully engaged in. But what I'm trying to do as we look at this passage is to say this is significant. This is a major part of what our church is able to do. It's not and shouldn't be the only thing, but it is a major part. It is a significant part of accomplishing the purpose that God has for us. It is something to be entered into with great joy. It is something to be celebrated. It is something to thank the Lord for, that we have funds to be able to do this. It is something to be pursuing in an increasing way, so that more and more of the world can be reached. And if you could look at my email or look at my mailbox, you would see that there are all kinds of missionaries that I regularly get appeals for that we end up having to turn down because our schedule is full, or we don't really know them, or there are other things that we need to be pursuing, other ministries to be engaged with. But the point is, there is no lack of opportunity. There is no lack of need. What Paul is talking about here is a continual, and it is an enormous need and part of the calling of the Church of Jesus Christ. Our problem is not that there are not people to support. Our problem is that there are too many of them to support, given everything else the Lord has called us to do. And these people will go so excited that a couple that actually been here, presented their work some years ago, going to Taiwan after, I don't know, it's been like 5 years that they've been on deputation. Finally, the Lord has worked to raise up their funds to be able to launch out very soon into their ministry. It's a very exciting thing. I really want to encourage us about this. I really want to emphasize the privilege and the opportunity that it is. I really want to encourage us to keep doing it and to do it even more. And I don't want to set some kind of a specific expectation here. And when you look at the New Testament about giving, there really aren't percentages that are given. The Bible in the New Testament does not talk about a tithe. It talks about people giving according to their ability and giving according to their desire. Really, the tithe, if anything, is viewed as a kind of a minimum, not as a I accomplished what I was supposed to do. What percentage? Let me just ask you this. And I don't have a right answer to this, but I do think this is a question that every one of us needs to seriously, before God, consider. As you think about the way you spend your money, what percentage of your overall income actually goes for gospel work, whether through this church or through some other endeavor? A passage like this urges us to take that question seriously and to ask the Lord, what should I be doing? And I want to mention that especially for the sake of our young people, because my impression is that our adults, you folks that are in the workaday world and established in life, many of you really are making a significant investment in the work of Christ. I don't know anything about money in this church. I don't know who gives what or how much. That's not my business. But the Lord, I think, has blessed us with generous people. What I want to say is, as our young people are growing up and you're thinking about, why am I in the world? And what are my goals in life? And what career should I pursue? And when I get there, what am I going to do with the money that I earn? What we're talking about here needs to be, in any Christian's life, a matter of a priority. And it is a big part of the way God would have us view material goods, is not how much I can keep and how much I can get, but how much I can give away for the sake of Christ. If God doesn't call me personally to go out to the ends of the earth, there is an enormous amount of good that any of us can do by sponsoring people that have been called to this kind of work. Material giving. One other point while we're talking about giving to these servants of Christ. It's not just about money. And you don't want to get the impression from this passage that Paul is, you know, either a beggar or a huckster or something like that, or just has a one-track mind as far as money. Notice some of the other comments that he makes here. Verse 23, he does say, I have longed for many years to come to you. Like, I really want to meet you people personally. I've heard so much about you. I've been blessed by your testimony. I want to meet you. And he says in verse 24 that when he gets there, he is eventually going to go to Spain. But then he makes this comment, once I have enjoyed your company for a while. Like, yes, I need your help, but I just want to get to know you people. And I know that being around you is going to be a great blessing to me. And I'm going to enjoy hearing your testimonies and knowing something of God's work in your life and interacting with you on a personal basis and sharing my own heart with you. I want to enjoy your company for a while. He wanted personal fellowship with these brothers and sisters in Christ. So we're not talking only about material giving. We're also talking about what I could call relational giving. That there would be the nurturing of a real bond with the servants of Christ. And you know that this kind of thing had to be one of the great sources of refreshment for the Apostle Paul in all of his wearying travels. I mean, you think about everything that this man faced. And the numbers, especially of his own people that rejected Christ as he went about preaching. And the buffeting that he took in a very physical way, and the imprisonments that he suffered, and all the sleepless nights, and all of the upheaval that he recounts in different books of the New Testament. This was daily life for him. And yet, he knew that he would receive a different welcome, a different kind of experience from these Roman believers. He would receive a warm embrace. He would see that they were genuinely interested in what he was doing. He would feel appreciation from these people. And he would receive their words of encouragement and their assurances of prayer. Paul says, I want to be with you for a while. Yes, I need to get going. I can't be here for a long time, but I so long for your fellowship. I want to enjoy your company. And here again, that is something that we as American Christians who have a strong local church family and Christian contacts from other circles, we get so used to Christian fellowship. It is just the normal thing we do. We show up to church, we're emailing people, we're on the phone with people, we're eating out with people, we're spending time with them, and this is just kind of the way life is. And we have no idea how the Lord is using that to keep us going in the right direction, to keep us accountable, to keep us encouraged, to keep us focused on the right things. And you take somebody out of a context like this and you throw them out in the middle of nowhere by themselves, the impact on them of having lost so much of that Christian fellowship, and the huge difference that it makes when somebody shoots them an email, when somebody picks up the phone and makes a long distance call, or the impact that it can make when they are traveling here in the States and they receive the kind of warm welcome that the Apostle Paul is expecting from these people. The sad reality is that in talking to missionaries, they will comment that sometimes the feeling they get from their churches is that this relationship with their missionaries is just something to sort of check off a list. That send them our money, we listen to what they have to say, we have a service for them every few years, and that often is the extent of it. Missionaries have kind of complained to me about that sort of thing, not reference to this church. And growing up as a missionary kid, I know the same thing. My parents getting used tea bags, literally, as a package from churches. Or getting put up in a dingy nursery to spend the night. This kind of treatment that indicates this really is not something that we care about very much. That is not what the Apostle Paul was longing for and expecting from the people in Rome. I was so encouraged at the solid group of people that was here this past Wednesday to hear the presentation that the Dieters has made about their ministry in Cyprus. And, you know, really, you may not realize that you're just being here, like sitting there and giving an hour of your time on a Wednesday night to listen to an update like that. Even your very presence is sending a message and is having an impact on people. In God's providence, we have another missionary couple coming this coming Wednesday. And I think we can have the same sort of ministry in their lives. We are involved in what's turning out to be a long-term project to update the missionary cottage. And we've been working on plans for this and announcing it here and there. Plans are still being firmed up, but it looks like before too long that building is going to go offline because it's got some significant wiring problems and probably the whole thing's going to have to be gutted. Rewiring, new interior walls. We already have the money provided for the new HVAC system. And, you know, when I'm thinking about the budget and how much money our church has available, and I'm thinking about the amount of money that's going into that little house, you do ask yourself the question, man, what more could we be doing with this money? How much more could be done even in our facilities or in other areas of the ministry to accomplish other projects? And then I think to myself, the Bixby's, the Coles, the Crockers, the Jensen's, and the amount of money that that little house represents in their efforts to get going to the field. And the ministry that that little house had in their lives and the appreciation they've expressed for it. This is a worthy investment. Why should the missionary house be in poorer condition than the house that most of us live in? These people deserve to be treated in a special way and to be shown that they are appreciated materially and in terms of our interest in their ministry as they are out serving the Lord. And we are encouraged by that example of Paul and the Romans regarding giving to the missionaries. But that's not the only kind of giving that he talks about here. And going into the rest of the passage, he's not talking about himself raising funds for his ministry. He's talking about a project that he is overseeing as far as raising funds for needy Christians, not evangelism now, but needy Christians back in Jerusalem. And that brings us to our second and final category here. We've talked about giving to missionaries. The rest of this is about giving to needy believers. And I want to share with you, as we look at these verses, a list of words that capture the spirit of Paul as far as this kind of giving is concerned. The first of them is the word priority. And that is in verse 25, he says, "At present, however, I am going to Jerusalem bringing aid to the saints." We may not realize what he's actually getting at there until we look at a map. The Apostle Paul was writing this letter of Romans to the Romans from the city of Corinth, which is in the area of Greece. And it would have been a very easy and very natural thing, right? He wanted so much to be with them. He wanted so much to go out to Spain. He had this God-given ambition. It would have been a very natural thing for him to get on a ship, to cross the Ionian Sea. He would be right in Italy. He could go right to Rome, and he could keep going on to Spain. But do you realize that is not what he does here? He does the very opposite. He turns around and goes hundreds of miles in the other direction back to Jerusalem. And it's like, well, I thought you really wanted to go and preach the gospel to these people. Well, yes, ultimately. But there is something else that is pressing on me that I've got to take care of, and that is very important as well. I'm going to give it priority, even if it means that for the time being, that other has got to be put on hold. I am at the present going over here to help these believers, these present Christians in Jerusalem, Jewish people who are struggling. Struggling perhaps because of a famine that had occurred sometime earlier. Perhaps because of persecution. We don't have a lot of details about exactly what was going on there. But Paul viewed it as something very important that was worthy enough to change his desires for the moment and go back over there to Jerusalem. And for us, as we kind of look at the window and see that going on, we have to ask, do I view my ministry, including my material giving to the needy among God's people, do I view it that way? Or do I view it as just kind of when it's just absolutely necessary or just kind of as a token? Is this something that's really a commitment on my part? The word priority. The second word would be the word ministry. As we look back at the passage, the expression there, bringing aid, is from a root that we've seen before. It's that root diakoneo or diakonos or diakonia, the word we get deacon from. It has to do with humble service being offered. We've seen that before in this passage. We have seen it referenced actually to Jesus Christ himself earlier in chapter 15, verse 8, being a servant to the circumcised. He ministers to people by laying down his life. The other word that we want to target here is in verse 27. It says that the Gentiles ought also to be of service to the Jews in material blessings. And that's actually the verb letutergeo, which has to do with, in some context, the offering of worship, service in a kind of a ritual way, what would be describing a priestly kind of service. And we've seen that before as well, because that terminology came up in last week's passage where Paul viewed himself as a priest who, in bringing Gentiles to Christ, is offering them to the Lord as an act of worship. And here we are talking about money that is being sent over to the Jewish people in that same kind of service and perhaps even divine service terminology. Why am I pointing this out? Well, it's to make this point. We look at Jesus and we say, Son of Man came to seek, to save that was lost. He came to serve and give his life a ransom for many. We view him as a servant. He is carrying out, of all things, a ministry. Right? He is in the ministry. The Apostle Paul, preaching like he was, evangelizing, pioneer work, he is in the ministry of all people. He is out there on the front lines preaching the gospel. Paul now takes the same terminology and he says, look, You are in the ministry by putting your dollars in the plate to help these Jewish Christians over there. That is a form of ministry. You don't have to have some special calling. You don't have to have some special skill. You don't have to have some compelling sense that this is just this overwhelming thing that God has called you specifically. You just have to have a few bucks, or maybe more than a few, and be willing to part with them. That is a ministry. You need to view it as something that is just as service-oriented, God-honoring, contributing to His work as what Paul was doing. It's a part of the whole package of ministry. And then the next item, as you look down at verses 26 and 27, it's actually two words here that I want to link together. And they both start with D. As you think about giving to help needy Christians, one of the ways we need to think is that this is a combination of delight and duty. A combination of delight and duty. Listen to what he says in verse 26 about those that had contributed to this other offering. For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some contribution. Verse 27, for they were pleased to do it. We could say it brought them pleasure. They saw it as a good thing. And when they parted with those funds, it wasn't that getting rid of the money itself felt good. They may have struggled. It may have hurt them. They had to give up other things they might want to do. But in a way, it did make them feel good. When you look at it from the standpoint of eternity, what is a better investment of $500? Is it to buy yourself another iPad? Or is it to look across the aisle and see that here's a church member who can hardly pay their rent? And it's not because they're lazy, and it's not because they haven't been pursuing ways to provide that for themselves. It is because of a legitimate circumstantial problem. What would, as a Christian, make you more happy? These people were pleased to do that. That's the spirit that Paul is encouraging here. Now, we have a lot of teaching on that because in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, Paul had actually been talking about this collection and raising funds, particularly among the church at Corinth. And here's what he says to them. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. You see that idea of joy in doing this and this bringing me delight. That is the spirit of New Testament giving. But all of this about doing it because you really desire it, it's on your heart, it brings you pleasure, doesn't put it on a level of, well, this is just kind of icing on the cake or optional. It actually is an obligation in the body of Christ. And in this case, he uses this kind of terminology in verse 27. They were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. You owe that to your fellow believers who are going through a time of need. It's a debt that you have. You may not have other debts, but you do have this kind of debt to be looking out for and providing for needy people. This is so hard. When it comes to ministry, giving money, or serving people in some other way, can we keep in our minds the fact that our efforts to serve are always going to be duty? There's always going to be a sense of obligation, and sometimes, immediately, I don't really feel like it, but I must do it because I'm supposed to. Duty and delight at the same time. That there is joy in serving Christ. And that even if I don't feel like it immediately, as I go forward and follow the Lord and do this thing that He's wanting me to do, and as I engage in ministry, I find by His Spirit that my heart really does receive a sense of satisfaction. I mean, what else am I in the world to do? To buy another iPad? I mean, who cares? These are useful tools. To buy another toy? to make more money, to make some investment, to get a bigger house? Who cares at the end of the day? When life is over and this world is made new and we're in the new creation and there are people suffering in hell and others who are in heaven forever, am I really going to care that I got some other toy? Not that there's no place for that. There is a book like Ecclesiastes, but a passage like this is giving us a perspective to say, here's what's going to bring me delight in eternity, to know that I made investments and that there are people here enjoying this with me because God enabled me in some way to participate either in their being brought to Christ or they're being encouraged to serve the Lord in life. Delight and duty, all mixed up together. And then there's one other word in the list here, and that's the word fellowship. You don't see that word so clearly in our translation, but it's there. When you look at verse 26, it says, Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some koinonia, is the noun form of this particular root. They have been pleased to make some sharing, is the idea. And it shows up as well in verse 27. For if the Gentiles have come to share, there's our word for fellowship, in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to share in the material blessings. Sharing is the idea. That's what fellowship is. Usually when we think about fellowship, we're thinking about the spiritual. So this has to do with sitting down with somebody and really engaging with them on a spiritual level, sharing from the Word of God, prayer, request, and that sort of thing. That is a part of it. That's a big part of it, because Paul does speak about sharing in spiritual blessings. But he ties the two of them together. He says, look, the Jews have, in a sense, shared of their spiritual blessings. And the way that the Gentiles can now express gratitude and connection with them, fellowship with them, is to share of their physical blessings. Because they happen to have more when these people have need. They shared one thing with you, you share back with them on a material level at least. And this was a characteristic of the New Testament church, right? The very first account of the New Testament church in Acts chapter 2, right out of the gate, it's saying things like, they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. It's like right there, the very first church that was established. And of course, James has some very strong things to say in chapter 2 about that whole issue. Like, what kind of faith is it that could see a brother in genuine need and say, go in peace, be warmed and filled without giving them the things that are necessary for the body? In Romans 15, Paul is talking that way, but he is making an even more specific point than those passages as far as this Jew-Gentile thing is concerned. Through the Jews, the Gentiles had received the gospel, and it was only the right thing to do for the Gentiles to respond by providing for the material need of the Jews. That was a way of showing gratitude, and it was a way of showing solidarity with them. That we're one. That we are one specifically in spite of these racial differences that have kept us apart for centuries now. Now, you know what a humbling thing it is when you're in need for somebody to give you money. I mean, it's uncomfortable. You feel embarrassed. And yet your heart is touched, and it has a way of really bonding you with somebody. Like, it moves your heart, like, man, they parted with this so that they could meet my need, and this means so much. All right, we know what it feels like. Probably all of us have been on the receiving end of that at some point. But what if it's a Gentile giving to a Jew? And these people had hated each other for centuries. And the Jews were looked down on and persecuted and rejected and maligned and opposed by the Gentiles, downtrodden, destroyed. I mean, you think about the history of the Jews. It didn't start with Hitler, that kind of oppression. This thing goes way back. There's just this weird hatred of God's own people. It's got to come from the evil one. And now some Gentile, his heart has been so transformed, he says, you know what? I really would like to buy myself X over here. I might even feel like I need it. Corinthians says they gave out of their deep need. It's like they didn't really have anything to give. They gave out of their deep need, and it's going to a Jew. I want you to know these kind of ethnic differences, these kind of racial differences are all behind us now, all things new in Christ. We're one family. There's solidarity here. And I want to show you my affection for you and my oneness with you by giving you this money. Paul, I'm sure, is hoping that that ministry would have the sort of bonding effect between Jews and Gentiles as it gets over there to Jerusalem. This was very important to him. And he'd been going through this fundraising effort for several years now. There are several passages that deal with it. He says in verse 28, he wants to complete the work, finally. Literally, it says as well, he wants to seal this fruit. Like, I want these people to understand that this isn't just money. This comes from a heart that's been made new by the gospel that loves you despite our past differences and all this baggage, and that views you as a brother in Christ. I want this to bring us together that way. And on a lesser scale, that is the kind of ministry that material giving has when we sacrifice for the good of our brothers and sisters. It is not just a financial transaction. It's not even just a show of compassion, but it is an act of spiritual fellowship where the material and the spiritual are linked together, and it is a concrete way of demonstrating that we are one family in Christ. Now, you might wonder if Paul is really trying to set up to go over there to raise funds for himself and his missionary work, why he spends really the majority of these verses talking about this other fundraising effort that was kind of different. Why spend so much of this passage talking about benevolence that had been raised for Christians in Jerusalem, if what he was trying to do primarily was to raise money for himself to go and evangelize? And I think we want to bring back this whole concept of a window. Because it seems to me that by getting into some detail about this other offering, it's like Paul is saying, now, you Roman Christians, I want you to look through this window. And I want you to see the transforming power of the gospel that is capable of tearing down these hateful barriers and bringing people together at the feet of the cross, the foot of the cross, so much so that they're sacrificing to help one another this way. When you support me, you're actually contributing to that kind of gospel drawing of people together around the cross. In other words, by looking at that fundraising project, he is trying to encourage them about the fundraising project that he is presenting to them. He's presenting them a window. And it's fascinating when you look at that Corinthians passage, that Paul does the same thing with the believers at Corinth. The Corinthians had apparently drugged their feet about doing their part in the whole thing. And Paul says, you know, these people in Macedonia, they've been ready a long time ago. And he goes on and on about, you know, they died to themselves because of the cross, by the grace of God. They were so generous. They were so sacrificial. This was an act of worship. It's like he's saying, here's a wonderful example for you people in Corinth. Now, you know, get going. Macedonians have started. They've given you a role model. Get going, do the same. Corinthians finally follow through. Now Paul raises up both Macedonia and Achaia, and he says, now you Roman people, all right, look at this wonderful example of how they did it. Now here's your opportunity to contribute to the advance of the gospel. Let it move your heart to give when you see other people give sacrificially for the glory of God. And there are other tie-ins to what is happening here in Romans. Let me just make one point and we'll close with this. You remember this foundational passage in Romans 12. Let me have you go with me to Romans 12, 1 and 2. And I want to end by reading this passage, but to have us be thinking about the financial giving that has been under discussion here. Paul says, Romans 12:1, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Notice he doesn't say, present your spirits. It is an act of spiritual worship. He doesn't say, present your songs, though that's worship. He says, present your bodies. In other words, there's a physicality about this act of worship and surrender. And the money is a part of that, is a part of physically demonstrating worship to God. And then he says, do not be conformed to this world. Is there a worldly way to think about your money? Is there a worldly way to think about your money? He says, let God transform the way you think about your money. We're going to talk about that in Romans 15. Just keep reading. It's like he's anticipating some of those same themes. That by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Resist the worldly way of thinking. Let God change your mind. Now you figure out before the Lord, what am I supposed to do? By testing you discern what is the will of God, reference to your giving. Your giving to the work of Christ through missions. Your giving to needy believers.